Hey man.
Richard.
Hello.
All right. All right, I'm ready to go.
All right, cool. All right, great. I did an intro for you already, but I just want to do it again here. This is season 3, episode 4. I'm interviewing Eric Hollerbach. I'm saying that right?
You are.
You have a name like me, like Dweck, like people still mess that up. So, yeah, I totally get it.
Everyone calls me Hollaback, but if people say it right the German way, it's Hollerbog.
Right. Oh, German. Okay. So you can still hear me?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay, I just propped my phone. So I wanted to ask you the, typical questions. I went on your website. You started in 2009.
Yeah, with stand up or
Stand up.
improv, what are we talking here? So I
Stand up.
basically started when I was six. Yeah, so when I was 16, I think that was 2002. I did my first show ever was literally at the Comedy Cellar. I had to bring four people for 5 minutes. So I basically took a bunch of my friends in my mom's minivan and drove down to New York City, took the ferry in, and it was expensive, but we did it. And I did that a couple times, and then I joined in 2003, the summer between my junior and senior year of high school. Gotham Comedy Club had a stand-up class taught by a guy called Dan Vitale, who was on Saturday Night Live for one season in 1985, and then he did too much coke, and I think he's dead now.
Oh.
But he was my teacher, and then there was a graduation show, and then I did a couple more sets when I was 16, 17, 18, and then I saw the Upright Citizens Brigade do an improv show, and then I kind of switched gears and just started doing improv classes. And eventually, when I was like 22, I was performing in a improv with the UCB.
That is like such a cool like story because, whenever I tell people like I did improv, I did local improv, and like people always think like, oh, was it UCB? It's like, no, it wasn't local improv. And like with you've done like so much. When you were initially starting out, like as a teenager, was it tough among other comics? Did they sort of rib you a little bit or roast you a little bit? Like, what's this kid doing here? This high school kid? Was there any type of that?
I mean, I wouldn't say that. I'd say my terrible performances spoke more than anybody could talk shit on me. I mean, the first time I did stand up, I thought I did okay, but I recently got a tape of it and it was garbage. It was terrible. I can't watch it.
Right.
My dad is from New Jersey. I was doing this thing like where I was giving my dad a vague foreign accent. Like, I was pretending to be him and it was like unclear if he was Greek or Swedish, and I was like, he's from New Jersey, so, and it just like nothing made sense. It was
Right.
terrible. It's embarrassing.
I saw this what's that show that Ira Glass had? I forget. He used to have that show, and he had a episode with Mike Birbiglia on the TV show version, and they showed it was basically an episode about kids doing stand up. They were like they did a stand up class, and it was so frustrating to watch because the teacher was so didn't seem like right for the job. Because like this kid, he did a really funny joke about like catfishing pedophiles on MySpace, and she said to him, this is what she said to him, sometimes it's more important to be likable than it is to be funny. And I thought, that's bullshit.
Whoa.
And like,
Oh my God.
isn't that like the worst thing to hear? Like,
That's actually the worst piece of advice possible. They're saying, having comedic integrity doesn't matter. Pander and be a fucking useless hack. That's what that advice is to me.
yeah. It totally like killed the like thing for me to like watch. I was like, this is terrible. And I've seen some
I mean,
kids.
I have encountered, you know, certain bookers at certain clubs that say, like, keep it clean, kid. You know, like, keep it clean. If you want to host this show, like, keep it clean. And it's like, are you kidding me? You just hired to headline at your club Jim Norton and Andrew Schultz and right. David Tell. Why should the host keep it clean? How about don't say shit to the fucking comic
right.
and let them do their thing?
And also, like, I think, know, like, if they got you to, this is what annoys me, if they got you to host, they should have done research and been like, what's this guy's act? Like, you know,
yeah.
if they want a clean guy, they should have sourced out, like, looked for a clean comic.
Yeah, you know, and any booker, I would say, hey, just go to erichollerbach.com, click the stand-up specials, you know, they're free on YouTube, you know. That's a sneaky plug I just put in there, but
I put them in the intro, and I wanted to ask you about that. I watched them, and I thought it was really cool how you edited them on YouTube. I was curious if you had gotten the influence at all from. I know Chris Rock did one of his specials where he did that. Like he had the jokes, but he had them like continue in different comedy clubs. In different like arenas, so like
yeah,
doing
you know,
one,
yep.
And I wondered if you got inspiration from that, or if it was just something that you came up on your own.
Yes, that was an inspiration. So I knew that Chris Rock did a special where it was like in Johannesburg and London, and then he like cut them all together. And then there was another one by Dave Attell called Roadwork, where it was in several different venues.
Yeah, I've
seen
that.
And I'd say Roadwork was a huge inspiration. The other, I also had budget constraints, and I also had different constraints. So, for example, I only got to headline on the tour twice. I headlined at Mesa, Arizona, has Comedy Off Main Street. So I did like 35 minutes on Comedy Off Main Street in Mesa, Arizona. And the other place I headlined was the Saloon in Houston, Texas. And so that was 45 minutes and 35 minutes or something like that. But so we drove from Los Angeles to New Orleans to New York City, and we shot like, you know, 50 shows on the road. I think it was like 30 something shows on the road, but then I moved back to Jersey and right. I did a bunch more shows. So it was like about 50 or 70 shows went into filming. And then I got my good buddy is from Tall Sea Productions, Colin McDowell is a good friend of mine, and we teamed up together and we had a script. And of all three specials, before I even went on the road, I had right. a script of all three specials. Conspiracies and dick jokes, this joke, this joke, this joke. Fart porn and beer halls, this joke, this joke, this joke. It's a medical device, this joke, this joke, this joke. But maybe, you know, I kept trying a bit that it wasn't working, and so I crossed it off, and then I came up with a new joke in New Jersey, and we added it. So some things gave and took there, but it was kind of like a budget thing, and also I thought it would be cool if a stand-up special, you know,
right.
Roadwork by Dave Attell was shot in four venues. Chris Rock's was shot in three or something like that. So I was like, what if we did 70, you know?
Right. That is, like, so cool. Like, it kind of sucks with the quarantine kind of, like, messed up what I was going to do, because what I was going to do was I was going to write, like, maybe it would take me, like, 2 years. I was going to write an hour of all the material I had, and then I was going to perform it in two places, at the Brighton Bar and at the George Street Co-op, because they had, like, a show which was How Long Can You Do? So I would do my own version. So I was like, I could do, like, 40 minutes in both of them and maybe tape them or record them and get them on Spotify or something. I saw people doing that with their stuff, and I was like, you know, and even if I didn't like tape it or record it at all, it would at least be like two live things I can do and be like, prove to myself, like, okay, I can perform live for 40 to 50 minutes. But then COVID happened and it was all like, well, this is going to take way longer. But
Yeah.
I thought with you, what was so great, and it's totally fitting, like, the names of your specials, like, the first one, Conspiracy Theories and Dick Jokes, I thought, that's fucking perfect for you. Did it take long to come up with the names?
No, you know, Bill Hicks, actually, I stole Conspiracies and Dick Jokes from Bill Hicks, I think. He said in an interview something like that.
Right.
Like, look, I'm just here to talk about conspiracy theories and dick jokes. He said, I think he said that one time, so I just stole that. He never used it as a title of an album, right. But I thought that was dope. So I took that from an interview with Bill Hicks. And then Fart Porn and Beer Halls, I thought, was just going with conspiracies in dick jokes. I was like, what's the weirdest thing that can happen in a different location?
Right.
So I just kind of mimed that formula, and then just, I thought, you know, I've also been to Germany. I've been to Oktoberfest, so I'm familiar with beer halls. It's something festive and fun. And then, like, why not watch only fart-related pornography there?
Right.
So I don't know how I thought of that, but it just came out of nowhere. And I wanted the title to be a standalone joke that I didn't even repeat in the special. The whole thing is just joke, joke, joke.
Right.
And then the third one, it's a medical device, is obviously to do with the most controversial joke of the series, the joke that kept it off Amazon Prime. You know, I was about to go on Amazon Prime, and then I got this email from them that my material was ridiculously offensive, and obviously it's not going to go on Amazon Prime. And I believe, so if I want to be funny or likable, I'm always going to choose funny.
Right. And I think, like, with you, you're so likable. And the thing that I love about you is you've been doing it a while. And the one thing that I love, and this might, like, shock you because it's such, like, a thing that you might think is, you know, universal, is you are so nice to younger comics, and that is really super important.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, I've been douched by assholes as recently as just before the quarantine, and I always hate it. It always leaves a bad taste in my mouth, you know?
Right.
When, let's say, for example, I was hosting a show, and then someone's like, you know, I go next because I'm famous, and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, forever, I will destroy you.
Right.
Forever, I will try to destroy you because you're being an asshole to me. How about ask me, oh, can I get worked into the list a little sooner? Okay, I'll work with you.
Right.
If you try to flex on me and douche me, fuck you forever.
Yeah.
So, you know, having some bad experiences like that, and also, you know, I don't want to name drop or anything like this, but there's a guy in Los Angeles that I'm friends with, kind of, called Tom Rhodes. Right before I went to go film my special, I sought Tom Rhodes out at the Comedy Store and asked him advice about what to do and how to record and this and that. And he told me to get a contract with my editor and make sure that he doesn't get fucked. He actually told me he went bankrupt doing something like I did. He went all through Europe and he had a camera guy follow him. And the camera guy was also supposed to edit, but he puts him up in hotel rooms. He's paying him more money than he's making, but he's making a stand-up special in multiple venues across Europe, you know? So he's like, he's got all this great footage, and he's got this guy to put it together. And then he literally went bankrupt giving this guy money every month, and the guy never edited shit. He didn't edit shit. So that was like a horror story that, anyway, but Tom Rhodes gave me, and then what he told me started to happen. So the guy that I traveled across the country with then didn't edit it, and it became a huge, like, I moved into my dad's house because I spent all my money on my special, and I couldn't even afford rent anymore, so I moved into my dad's house. My dad's drinking, he's, like, being verbally abusive, saying I'm a loser compared to my siblings, blah, blah, blah. I called the guy, the camera guy. I was like, so, you know, what's going on? He's like, oh, family, can you send me more money? I need to work on this, you know, and like literally produced zero editing. So that conversation with Tom Rhodes, Tom Rhodes was so above me. Like, he tours Europe. He had his own TV show in Amsterdam. He had his own sitcom.
Yeah, I know who Tom Rhodes is. He's great.
NBC. And just watching him deal with other people, I was like, I'm going to act like that now, you know?
Right. I think that's the one thing that's, like, cool to me is, like, I guess, the, like, you've sort of, I guess a lot of people who've been in it long enough have lived sort of the dreams that I want is, like, you've been able to meet, like, a lot of comics. So, like, has that, like, when you meet, like, a Tom Rhodes or stuff like that, do you feel like once you meet them and you kind of become, like, comrades with them, do you feel like they like your stuff and they, like, you know, like you're sort of in with them a little bit? Like, you feel like you're one of them? Does it validate?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just like all the comics at the Brighton Bar, you know, the really funny ones I'm really nice to, and then you build a relationship, and then you perform in front of each other, and then, you know, when they get a show, maybe they put you on it. You
right.
know, it's just how everything works. But, yeah, I would say my relationship with Tom Rhodes is more of like a mentor thing. Like, I've sent him emails, you know. In New Orleans, I got banned from multiple clubs, and I was really depressed because, you know, some of the New Orleans comics hated me, and they banned me from their club, and then I sent him an email, and he sent me, like, a beautiful email back of, like, how to deal with bullies and this and that, and he just, the fact that he took the time to do that, you know, when I was, like, in need of guidance, he's more of, like, a mentor.
Yeah, you know? That's so cool.
I wouldn't use his relationship to be like, hey, can I get on this show? Unless I had mainstream success. If I had mainstream success and I could help him and I help him a couple times, then I might ask for, but it's like, it's important to know how to deal with people ahead of you. Like, don't bother them too much. And,
oh yeah.
You know, keep, you know, I wouldn't ask like, hey, if he got on, you know, Madison Square Garden show, I wouldn't be like, hey, can I open for you?
Right.
Because that would kind of torch the relationship. Unless I was played Madison Square Garden, I would ask him, you know, and then he would use. Now, he's got a lifetime of contacts all over the world of different shows, you
right.
know. So, you know, it's like I got to help him before I ask for help. It's just
right.
important how to deal with that. Yeah.
I started this, like, kind of segment of questions with Dan when I interviewed him, and I kind of want to keep going with it. Do you have, like,
sure.
you probably have tons of stories of, like, what I would call, like, hell gigs, like, gigs that didn't go well. Do you have any, like, stories of, like, that, like, things that just crazy?
I mean, I could, stories of things that didn't go well, I mean, yeah, that would take, like, four more podcasts. I mean,
right.
just for example, if you watch Fart Porn and Beer Halls, available free on YouTube, you can see that when I'm in D.C., okay, so I told you at the beginning, like, I had this script of all the jokes in order.
Right.
And I got, when we were in El Paso, Texas, me and the camera guy got hassled at the border because we had California plates and we were in Texas crossing the border. They wanted to make sure we weren't Mexicans or hiding Mexicans in the trunk.
Right.
It's a border town. So the immigration people, like, literally searched the car. And they also, like, damaged our camera equipment. They were, like, taking out all of our camera equipment, and they sent a dog in our fucking car and looking for drugs or Mexicans. And so after it was such a stressful experience that afterward, I started coming up with a bit about police dogs. Like, you know, this police dog, he's outranks everybody. You know, we
right.
can't do anything, let's send in the dog. And then the dog is the judge, jury, and executioner. So I had all these dog jokes, like, you
right.
know, there's seeing eye dogs, there's this kind of dog. Pretty soon, dogs will be doing surgery if there's a squeaky toy. I'm doing the stupid dog material, and I get to Washington, D.C., and this lady starts going, dogs are smarter than you. The dog is smarter than you. I went to Iraq and Afghanistan. We had military dogs, and they're smarter than you. She kept on doing it. They were hammered. And what I didn't know about Washington, D.C., is they have bottomless mimosas at every brunch.
Oh.
So people, every Sunday between 11 a.m. and 5 p.m., a great majority of the white girls in D.C. are hammered on bottomless mimosas. And somehow they managed to find themselves in a comedy club and then were very annoyed that they weren't getting attention.
Right.
And I'm just like, it's the next thing in the script. We drove, you know, 10 hours that day to get to that venue. We show up right on time. blah, blah, blah. I get on the list, blah, blah. Okay, now I got to bang out these three jokes. The dogs are smarter than... So, like, I finish my set, but I'm all flustered because I'm like, you know, when the heckler starts heckling you, you're supposed to, like, you know, have some comebacks. But
right.
In my head, I was just like, oh, my God, can I just tell these fucking two jokes and shut up?
Right.
So I was so frustrating.
And,
but, I mean, there's been 100. Yeah. I mean, there's been 100.
Right. And I think, like, with that, what's so interesting to me about that is, like, I don't mean to, like, you know, judge or anything, but you didn't have – were you just so spaced from, like, writing it that your improv stuff just wouldn't have saved you?
I just knew, like, look, we're staying at hotels, you know, where I have to feed my camera guy.
Right.
I only have X amount of shows left in the series. I want to book every... So that pressure was on me, and then my improv skills went away because I was like, what the fuck? Like, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
I mean, I did go back and forth with her, but then when she wouldn't shut up, I, like, gave up. I'm like, I can't perform now.
Right.
And then the host of the show that night, Charlie Ross, as soon as I got off, and this is all in the special, he kicks them out. And it takes a lot of time to get... We cut a certain chunk out, but it took a lot of time to get those ladies out of the room, you know?
Yeah, that's always just, like, terrible to have hecklers like that. Like, I just would think with you, like, that is such, like, a terrible thing. I would hate that. Like, you write something out so much, and, like, I know from experience a little bit of, like, trying to write that long of material and be, like... I can't imagine, like, how much that would have, like, terrified me.
Yeah, and it's like, think about this. I'm spending, like, $15,000 on my dream specials. Like, you know what I mean? I'm trying, in my head, I'm going to sell it to Netflix and get my money back. But, like, I have a certain budget. I have a certain time, filming days left. And it's just like, can you just shut the fuck up? Right. So I was, like, disappointed in myself that I wasn't able to improv more with her, but
right.
the situation I was in behind the scenes was sort of like stressing me out.
Right. I wanted, since we're talking about like improv and stuff, I wanted to ask you, you did a character on last time at the open mic, and what was her name?
Mindy. Are you
right.
talking about Mindy?
That was,
and her husband Gryson.
Yeah. That was amazing, and I thought it was, like, you just had that room. And what's great about that mic is, like, I love that people now are starting to do, like, experimental stuff now that we have an audience a little bit. But it's, like, I thought that was great that you took that chance and were able to really work that out. Have you had that character for a while, or was that, like, new?
You know, I'll tell you, and I keep on, you know, I'm just going to keep plugging my shit over and over again.
Yeah,
but
sure.
Literally, so on the road, I'm in Texas, and every gas station we stop in, everyone's like, well, how to do it, you know? And so we're driving across the country filming the special, and just, like, the accent. First of all, I'm also, like, driving 12 hours every day, going from Dallas to Houston to Amarillo to this place to this place. And so, like, there's a lot of time to kill in the car,
right?
You know, between these gigs.
Right.
So in the car, I just started just hallucinating because we were driving for so long.
Right.
And I just hallucinated that I was a housewife in Texas, and she's always chasing after her husband, Gryson. Gryson, he's my husband, but he drives crazy sometimes. He flipped a Ford Bronco into a ditch, but he's a handyman. He just grabbed a dildo out the glove compartment, popped that sucker in his backhand. He tied a trailer hitch to a Bronco he'd been drinking, and he just ran the car out the hill. I put it in neutral. He ran it at the top of the hill. The dildo popped out of his butt like, and I thought the tire popped, but that was just him removing the hitch. Christ, and he's crazy, you know.
Right.
Me and my friends, Bessie Sue and Susie Best, think that I should just go to church and drink whole milk and stare out the window and watch the Lord's grass grow. But for me, that's not exciting at all. So So I just started like nonstop doing this character for like, right. you know, 7 hour stretches.
That is,
and I just made
so
it
cool. Like,
more and more elaborate.
For me, like, you know, what's interesting about that whole thing is like, I think my sense of humor sometimes is a lot like, people don't know how dirty my sense of humor is. So like, when I was laughing like really hard, like I think people were surprised like at some of the stuff you were saying, like, oh, Richard finds that hilarious. Like, I never like thought that about him. I always wondered.
Well, you know, yeah, you do some dirty jokes
but, like,
sometimes.
For me, like, I just am so envious of people who can do that, like characters and stuff. Because when I did improv, I had three characters. One was a vice principal that was extremely based off of Lewis Black, and he was like giving like a speech to like the seniors before the prom to not dance like suggestively with each other, like don't dance like you're fucking like rabbits. And then another I had was like this, it was based off this teacher that I had when I switched schools, and it was this like kind of like in the closet gay like music teacher that was like trying to control these kids that are just terrible, and he's just like, oh, we're gonna have like, oh, you can't say that word, Timmy, during the school play and stuff like that. But I could never do like voices or anything, so I'm so envious of that. Like, have you always been able to do that, or is that just like something you had to learn, like the accents and the voices and everything?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So, you know, I started with stand-up, but then I, you know, like I say, I botched this crazy accent, and I never really committed to one accent when I was playing my father character in stand-up. And then I went to the Upright Citizens Brigade, and if your scene partner would walk out and go, "Oi, we're at sea, we're lost at sea," you know, you don't want to come up and join the scene without a pirate accent.
Right.
So if your scene partner endowed you that you're a pirate, you got to do your best fucking pirate voice possible to make the scene, to round it out and make everyone's talking like this, and then we're going to battle another boat. And you can have so much fun with improv if everyone's like on the same page.
Right.
So that training really stretched me. And I had some great teachers. Like, I was literally taught by Chris Gethard. Like, Zach Woods was
right.
one of my teachers
That's
for a while.
So, cool.
So I just had such good teachers. And Jackie Clark was my level one teacher. And, you know, Jackie Clark was, she also, like, she liked me in class so much, she actually got me some auditions outside of class that she, I found out later, she only gave me that opportunity and not one of the other students, you know. So there was like certain like mentors that were at the UCB that were also like really encouraging. Like my level two teacher was a guy called Doug Moe. And then he also got me to, you know, perform with the UCB.
Right.
He was the coach of our performance team. So, you know, just that experience stretching myself and just realizing that if you just commit and keep committing, like my first couple jokes with the Mindy character at Brighton Bar the other day, like didn't land, but I stayed in the fucking character and I kept imbuing
right.
Grace with more and more ridiculous details. So by the third joke, I'm telling about Grayson. Now everyone knows that Grayson is a weird gambler
right.
who sucks dick on bridges. And he somehow, you know, sucks his way out of county jail. And also we have a gazebo, you know. Right. And so the scams that Grayson's always pulling off is like the joke of the whole character.
And then I think what got me and what got everybody was when you did the very uncircumcised, like.
Oh, yeah, Grayson, he's very uncircumcised. Yeah, if he had one circumcision, he would still have more than the average amount of foreskin. It would take between 3 and 7 circumcisions to fully get his foreskin off, depending on the equipment used in the surgery. He could astroturf a whole football field. You know, his penis has been described as a blobfish at the base and a eel going through a sea cucumber. It's very elaborate, a lot of moving parts, you know, just...
Literally, if you had done more of that, if you had done more of that, I would have been on the floor, literally, I would have been on the ground, this is insane. And this is so cool, when we can do that kind of stuff. I don't know if you were there. I don't think you were there for a couple weeks ago. Jack Steiger did a bit where he played he was back on drugs, and it was just he was pretending to do coke while doing his set, and it was just fantastic, creative shit. And it's just I love when people can do that.
Yeah, I'm also in a phase where I'm trying to build up new material. I burned 90 minutes of my material on my specials that I just put out, so I'm trying not to do any of that material anymore.
Right.
And so, it's I think it would be fun to do a whole, 10-minute set as just Mindy. And, if I did another stand-up special, I would just have a Mindy segment where it's just 10 right. minutes of me wearing a wig and a shitty, Southern Belle dress.
Right.
And just coming out like that, and just be full Mindy the whole set and just say the most fucked up shit.
Right.
And, yeah.
So when you did, improv and stuff like that, did you ever get, you mentioned auditions. Did you ever get any urge to do any type of acting, with it or anything?
So I went to Eugene Lang College at the New School for liberal arts, and I studied creative writing, and my favorite class was screenwriting.
Right.
So I would love to screenwrite. My ideal career to have would be someone like Ricky Gervais, who screenwrites, he makes movies, right. then he does a stand-up special, then he makes a movie, then he does a stand-up special. To me, that's the best life possible.
Yeah.
So I would love to do that. And plus, if you look at my website and you go to the screenwriting section, I've created 6 screenplays. And a couple of them, I wrote a character for myself. Or I thought to myself, if I got this, I would want to play that character. But some of them, I would just like to direct them and have no acting in them. But I did, I got a couple little acting opportunities in New York. There's something that you can still find this if you go to MTV Artist of the Week. There's One Republic, the band One Republic had all these sketch interstitial segments, and I appeared in a couple of those.
That's cool. I was really into learning how to screenwrite when I was in high school. Before I did comedy, that was sort of growing up. What I wanted to do was write for TV and movies, because I always thought that would be also a really independent thing to do, and also really as a kid loving comedy. And also I think for me, I don't know this about you, but before I did stand up, there was so much comedy that was around that just wasn't very good. I don't know if you relate to that. Everyone, especially when I started getting into comedy more hardcore, I was I can't watch another Jeff Dunham special with people. I'd just be this is not So when I started seeing Mark Maron and Louis C.K., I thought these guys are fucking great. And was comedy this is such a generic question, but was comedy a big thing in your household? Were you into it? Was your family into it?
Yeah, I definitely remember the first spark in my family that really struck me as in a philosophical way, where I was wow, comedy is really powerful. And it's just as simple as this. In my house growing up, I'm in middle school. I'm in fifth grade. My sister's in eighth grade.
Right.
And, we're not allowed to curse. We can't say bad words in the house. Mm-hmm. But my mom, every time she would drop a glass, she'd go, shit. And she would stub her toe on the coffee table. She'd go, shit.
Right.
And then if she opened a bill that was past due, she would go, shit. But we weren't allowed to curse.
Right.
And my sister one day, at the dinner table in front of both my parents and God himself, everyone was there. And my sister just goes, you know what, Mom? This is you. oh, shit. Oh, and then she would, like, bump into the wall. Shit. And then she went over here. Shit. Oh, I spilled my milk. Shit. She goes, that's what you sound like. And my parents were both laughing hysterically. And I was like, my mouth was wide open because never did my sister swear in front of my parents before. This was the first time she ever did. Like, right. openly swore in front of my parents, like, a lot. And they were laughing so hard that she didn't get in trouble. And I was like, what is this witchcraft? Right. You know? You're not allowed to swear. That is one of the Ten Commandments of our family. And right. my sister just did it, and she had our parents laughing, and there was no consequences.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the fuck? Like, you can break the rules if you're funny? And that was, like, on a philosophical level, I always remember that. That, like, got tattooed into my soul, you know?
I sort of had that with, in school. Like, I was a very, like, not timid. Like, I wasn't shy as a kid. I never liked giving myself attention. I never liked, you know, causing a scene or anything. But, like, when I became a teenager, like, 14, 15, I became more of, like, smartass, really. So, like, when I got right. picked on, instead of being, like, you know, total pussy like I was, I would say stuff back. And whenever I did comebacks and stuff, I never got in trouble. My teachers always laughed, which was a bad thing, because kids would get mad at me that were picking on me. They'd be like, oh, the teacher's laughing at Richard making fun of us back at us. Like, so it's like...
Right. And it like enforces the insult. So if you insult somebody and then someone else laughs in acknowledgement of the truth of the statement, it's always worse.
Yeah, so
you
like
know?
That always happened with teachers. Like they were always on my side with that. They'd be like, "Oh, that's funny." That's like,
yeah. Well, you're defending yourself,
right?
You know.
And I think that's
the
like,
bully's being a bully.
A cool thing with comedy, just to have that total like, there's a lot of power to it that it gives you, and I think that's like yeah. just the thing that. Really can drive you to do it is just having this power in your life that you never had before.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, can I ask you a question, Richard
sure.
Dweck? Now, you had a personal problem with somebody that did a podcast with you and you thought that they were being a bully to you. Do you know what I'm talking about?
No. Well, maybe. That's vague.
You don't have to name names, but I remember you did a Facebook post that you were really frustrated. You did somebody's podcast and you just felt like they were like exploiting you and like making fun of you the whole time, right?
Oh, I can't remember if there was, I can't remember that. I know.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe. But, it's always
well,
like,
I think yeah. Caprio and Liam, you know, did a podcast
that,
with you.
That was a total case of me being oversensitive. Like, I love being made fun of. And I have, and it's very funny because, like, you know how people, like, I'm sort of this thing, like, Richard Dweck. Like, I had that in school and people would make fun of me, but I hated it because I was too sensitive. Like, I think high school would have been a lot easier for me if I was able to take a joke back then like I can now. But like
yeah.
what happened with the whole Liam thing, which is so embarrassing, was I was just like, it's so weird. Like it's such a terrible thing to do, but I do it all the time, is I have depression and anxiety. So like I sort of blame my actions on that shit way too much. So I was, like, in a really bad place, and I was just, like, he said something to me, and it was not, like, super bad, but it was, you know, it stung, and I was just, like, so sick of, like, just at that moment that I deleted him from everything, which was a bad idea.
I remember we talked that night, and
yeah.
I was like, look, you know, he's just kind of like a white trash person who's trying to do shock comedy. Like,
yeah.
it's not a big deal.
And then
know?
He explained to me that it wasn't serious, and I was like, yeah, you know, I was just like, it was a bad thing to me because I overreacted. And, like, to me, what's a flaw about me is I'm very, like, I wish that I had more hindsight because I regret a lot of stuff and I dwell on a lot of stuff, but that doesn't change me from being impulsive. So, like, I can be way too impulsive sometimes. Like
right.
Like what happened with Kyle Groom, I was listening to, he has a new podcast, and one of the comedians said on a podcast, on that podcast that Liam has, that when they saw him for the first time, that they thought he was the worst comic. And Kyle has improved immensely since he started, like, 2 years ago. Like, he's way better than he was. But it really flustered him and really annoyed, and it really hurt his feelings that, like, this guy hadn't seen him since he'd gotten better. And I thought, like, if that had happened to me, I don't know how I would have reacted, because I'm so impulsive. I don't know how I would have, like, treated that. Like, he treated
it. As you get more experience, you just kind of, like, can categorize insults, or just be like, you know what, there's a class of comics that are just old and bitter, and they want to take the, you know, instead of being nicer to the new comics, the up-and-coming comics, because maybe that up-and-coming comic later will be successful.
Right.
There's a certain amount of people that are just bitter at the end when they get older, and it hasn't, you know, Comedy Central has never called them, HBO has never called them, and they're winding down in their career. And instead of being, like, a helpful mentor, they're just a dumb, drunk piece of shit that tries to, like, dream kill younger comics. And I hate that. And I haven't seen a lot of successful comics do that behavior. I have seen one successful comic do that behavior. But, you know, it's normally the comics that never made it and are older and have headlined a couple shows that are just, like, they're just shitty to younger comics. And, you know, if you want to spread joy as a comedian, I don't know why you would be shitty to younger comics. I don't get it.
We were, when I was with John on Monday, we were going home, and we were talking about this one comic, and he's a perfectly nice guy, but he's like a boomer, and he does very boomerish, like, material. And I said, he's and I always feel with those guys, those older guys, like, you're trying to, I made, like, a Back to the Future joke. Like, have you ever seen Back to the Future?
Yeah.
Like, I was like, they want to step into a time machine and go, like, punchlines. Where we're going, we don't need punchlines. Like, you know, they just, they're going, and it's just, like, the stuff he talks about is so, like, it's not, like, overly offensive, but it's just, like, this isn't the 80s anymore. Like, you can't talk about women and people like that anymore. Like, there has to be some sort of, and it's not like offensive, it's just like the jokes are shitty.
I think I know who you're talking about, but yeah
it's just like, oh,
that, no, I get it. Yeah, I just try, you know, man, I just really try to be nice to everybody and have good karma, and hopefully, you know,
right,
that helps me. I, you know, it's just easier.
This is such, like, a vain, like, kind of question for me, because I'm so self-conscious, is you've been doing a lot of interviews for a long time for your podcast, Roadway Diary, right? Highway Diary.
Highway Diary. You've been on the Highway Diaries twice. Roadway Diary. Unbelievable.
But for me, I just wanted to ask, like, you've told me, like, a couple times, but do you think I'm getting better at interviewing?
Oh, you mean between the first time we talked and the second time we talked?
I just mean in general, like, with this podcast, like, how it's going now. Like, if I'm doing a good job, in your opinion, of, you know, keeping the conversation.
This podcast, you're a beautiful angel of God. It's, you know, the more you do anything, the better you get at it. So, you know, I'm on, like, episode 266, and, you know, when I go back to episode 15, I'm, like, cringing because I'm so terrible, you know?
Right.
So, but yeah, I think you're getting better.
Okay.
This has been going great.
Yeah.
I've been having a good time.
Good. Have you, with quarantine and stuff, have you been doing any of the mics that are, like, online, like, mics at all? Do you do any of that?
No.
Me neither. No. To me, it just feels like whenever I do Instagram or something, like, it just feels like vlogging, and I just, like, I'm not good with that at all. And
I mean, if I got paid to do, like, a private virtual show, I think I'd do it, but I'm not going to seek out, like, any open mics or anything like that that are online. I don't believe in it. You know, I got my degree in screenwriting. I'm very much into the thing of, like, planning it, filming the best quality, you know, with the best cameras and putting it out that way, and like, you know, a shitty onboard on your laptop camera,
right,
with no editing, or people can just go to my website, erichollerbach.com, click on stand-up specials and see conspiracies and dick jokes, right, with perfect editing. And like, that's where things should be videoed, like specials. But like a video Zoom show is just, right, like, it defeats the purpose. Cause you know, if the audience is in front of me laughing, then I know I'm doing a good job. If,
yeah,
the audience is like muted their microphones, you know, I don't know what we're doing here.
I had a joke about that. Like, my first joke that I wrote about that was like being quarantined was that it's like trying to do like cam stuff when you're a stripper. It's like, you know, if you have tits,
exactly,
it's easier. But like with comedy, then the same thing with like a stripper is like they get money thrown at them for certain moves they do. We get laughs at us for certain jokes we do, and we know that we can keep that in our set. So like for me, it's like I need to know like my comedy tits,
yeah,
don't work online. And that's
right,
frustrating, because I want to be able to, like, I've done some stuff with like TikTok and stuff. It's just like I don't feel like my humor can connect to anything other than doing stand-up live, which is frustrating because some people can, like, you've seen Waldo, like, he does some great stuff, and like some people do great sketch stuff, and just like I can't do that.
Yeah, no, Waldo's great, you know, but you need a live audience. And I love your analogy, because it's like, if you're a stripper, how do you know that you got a really hot ass if you're not grinding it on,
right,
random businessmen and they're popping a boner between,
right,
your cheeks?
Yeah.
You know, I'm all about the in real person type of shit.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think like live comedy is such like a great like thing. I think live anything, you know, it's so, I get so annoyed when I watch like some comedy specials, like I watch and I'm like, I can imagine this was so much fun to be there, but like it just doesn't capture it sometimes.
Yeah, being in live, you know, and that's the thing. It's like when the room is all together and out there, there's Black Lives Matter, there's Republicans versus Democrats,
right,
there's police, you know, brutality and this and that. And, you know, there's so many touchy subjects. But when an audience drops a punchline and the room cracks in laughter together, that is,
right,
a different politics on everything. That's how our society heals. That is the,
right,
best method of healing the culture's ills, is making fun of the bad guys in the,
right,
society.
And
so, you know, to have it virtual, it's just like, ugh,
right,
you know?
And you mentioned earlier Bill Hicks. I kind of did like recently like a binge on his stuff, and it was just like with him, what was so like interesting to me was just to be able to be a part of a generation that like he was ahead of and didn't really like enjoy, like, you know, he's one person that I feel like, you know, if he was here today, people would be disappointed because he wouldn't be doing comedy. Because
what do you mean by that?
I don't think
you think he was like too political and
no
not,
I think what would happen is he absolutely like he hated people who watched too much TV. Do you think he'd be on Instagram and Twitter and, you know, in social media at all? I think he would despise social media, and I think he would have really good jokes on it, but I don't think he'd be in public as much. I think he'd be like the guy who made like Calvin and Hobbes, where he's like, you don't see him at all anymore.
Yeah, you know, and to me, Bill Hicks and Dave Attell have a lot in common. Like, I think Dave Attell like doesn't even have an iPhone, and
right,
he has no social media presence. It's like, what do you want the comedian to do, you know?
Right.
You know, burn his barely formed jokes on social media? Or do you,
right,
want him to shut, like, leave the guy a fuck alone and, you know, give him a couple weeks to write. And then, you know, he'll show up at the Stress Factory or the Funny Bone with all new material and be the funniest fucking person in the world. Or do you want him sitting 6 hours a day, you know, taking pictures of his own ass on Instagram?
Right.
It's like fucking, you know. It's like, how can you read if you're on Instagram in, you know, whatever, in posting your butt pictures or this or that, right. or your pictures of your fucking steak. It's like, I need time to sit inside, read, and write. Right. So that's what the life of a comic is, you know? So, yeah.
I listened to, recently, I was also listening to Doug Stanhope, and he reminded me a lot of Bill Hicks in that when he started doing international stuff, like, it's hard, it just happens. Like, America has no, can't make fun of themselves a little bit and aren't self-aware. So you have to go to these other countries, and they're, like, you know, so much better audiences.
Yeah, and I also think, you know, Americans being able to make fun of ourselves ruthlessly and being able to just, like, have this, like, fuck it, wild west attitude, you know, I think a lot of, there's a lot more decorum of behavior in the UK, and, you know, American comics that really go for it have a place in European audiences. You know, right. Tom Rhodes has proved that, you know, so.
Have you ever, I know you've mentioned, like, being in Germany, did you do comedy over there?
I tried to. So I was an Ausstudenten. I was an exchange student. We had a German kid stay with us called Joachim Lachenbach. And I went to Krefeld, Germany, and I stayed with his family. Mm-hmm. And so I speak German. And, you know, the girls, it was very motivating because the German girls in the high school were so goddamn sexy that, and I may have, you know, taken a girl out to a date and made out with her. And, you know, it was a good time.
Right.
When I went back to Germany with my father for Oktoberfest in 2018, and the closest place to do comedy was in Berlin. Berlin had English speaking comedy nights, and that was like a 6-hour train away from Munich to Berlin. So it just wasn't possible. But you know, to do comedy in German, I don't think my skills are there yet. I would have to, like, live there for a while to do it in German. So I was, like, looking for an English show.
Yeah, I don't know his name, but there's a comedian that's in some other country. Like, I forget where. And, like, he gets in trouble now because, like, people have realized, like, he just... I think he's in some type of Indian, like, obscure Indian country, and he's, like, copying jokes word for word because, like, they don't have comedy in that country. So, like, he's the only stand-up. And instead of doing, like, his own material, he does all these, like, classic, like, myths from other comedians. It's like, that's Jerry Seinfeld's bit. Like, how do they not realize? Like,
it's kind of genius. Yeah. There was a guy who was, like, a master forger of Picasso. Like, you can make a whole living just, like, studying a Picasso painting and, like, making a perfect forgery by using his brushstrokes, reading Picasso's autobiography, reading how he paints, reading his method, and then studying his paint, and then, like, trying to making a forgery and selling it for millions of dollars. It works until you get caught, you know?
Yeah. I think that was, like, early on one of your episodes of your podcast, you were talking about that guy, and I think I've seen a couple of them, the impressionists that, like, steal jokes.
The impressionists that steal jokes. Oh yeah, I remember this. Oh yeah. Yeah, there was a comic that came through. Oh my god, did this guy make me mad?
When
he
I
made
was
me so
club,
mad.
I think I saw him and he was so
Yeah, I think he quit, but dude, this guy made me mad. So, you know, you said very generously that I'm nice to up and coming comics and new comics. I'm nice to them, right?
Yeah.
Well, when a comic goes on stage and does a series of impressions of comics, I go, you can be an impressionist and that's fine, but you can't impersonate other comics and then steal all the things that are funny about them, like steal all their funny mannerisms, steal, like, do you understand that you can't do you understand why you can't do that? Because you're stealing their shit, you know? And he's also, like, not making fun of them. He's using their moves to get laughs. Right. And I was like, you can't do that. You got to write your own fucking joke. Like, if you want to impersonate, you know, Donald Trump or, like, a politician or, you know, Nancy Pelosi, sure. The one people that you can't comedically impersonate are comics when you're just biting their shit.
Right.
Like, there's... There's only like fucking two rules or fucking three rules of having integrity, being a fucking stand-up. And one of them is don't steal jokes, but going along with don't steal jokes, don't impersonate fucking comics.
Right.
And then do their shit, you fucking idiot. Yeah. This guy argued with me tooth and nail, tooth and nail, tooth right. and nail, and then he quit. So fuck him. You know, I mean,
I think
when I tell, you know,
that's
my
one
God.
Of the greatest, you know, we, a lot of comedians that I talked to, what was great was when quarantine was like about to happen, like we were just starting to go into it. We're like, so many people are going to quit. Like, and we had, we had a couple of people who just like have stopped coming to the Brighton Bar that we were hoping would quit. And they did. And it was just like, you know, you don't want it to happen all the time, but like sometimes people have to be, people always weed out like the ones who aren't supposed to be, you know, it sounds obvious that like people who aren't meant to do it don't really do it for a while, don't do it long.
Yeah, I mean, if you're not getting laughs and you're not motivated to write, but you just want attention and, you know, then you have an excuse comes out for you. The quarantine excuse comes out for you, then, you know, maybe you back out from it. But, you know, you have to be very self-motivated to be a comic and, you know, you got to find the places to perform, actually fucking drive there, you know.
We only have a few minutes left, so I don't want to, like, totally get into this whole thing, but I wanted to ask you, like, are you worried at all that it's going to happen again with No Joke November? Or do you think people are going to not do that because of just us being, you know, like, stuck in quarantine? Like, has that, do you think that has changed, like, people's perspective of, like, okay, I have, like, one chance to do this open mic once a week. Like, I'm not going to screw it up with doing this No Joke November nonsense.
Well, let's just explain to your audience what No Joke November was. So Franco Danger is a brilliant comic, a very good friend of mine, and he came out with this thing of No Joke November, No Old Joke November, meaning he's not going to dip into any of his new material. He's just going to go on stage sometimes with almost nothing. He's going to have no jokes to force himself to write new jokes. Now, this, we're talking about having excuses built in. This started being permeated, and I would go around New Jersey last November and do comedy, and like fucking half the comics on the lineup are like, I got No Joke November, I'm doing No Joke November, and would fucking stare at you for fucking 5 minutes and tell 30 seconds of jokes for 5 minutes of a set and continue to stay on and not elect to give the mic back to the room. So over and over, comics would just do nothing on stage. Yeah. And it was just like, okay, if you're going to do that, if you're, it's not no right. It's not, it's New Joke November. It's not No Joke November. It's so creating, I was getting really frustrated.
Yeah. And like, I totally get that. Like, to me, it's like, you got to have that skill set. Like, to me, whenever I riff, I always feel like there's just like a mix. It's like, sometimes it happens. Sometimes I can make a joke off the cuff. But like, to really, like, just go up there with nothing, it's just like, you need to have that skill set. Like, I feel like you can do it and Franco can do it because he has little things of like, okay, I have this family member and I can just like get juice out of that. It's like, you gotta have a source from somewhere to get your comedy, because when you don't, especially when you don't have the tools, that's the biggest thing. It's just having the tools to do what you do.
And that's a big thing for me in my development as a comedian is like, you know, I started with stand-up and then I got like 9 years of improv experience. And then when I went back to stand-up, to me, it was like sometimes when I first started back, I would be like, oh, I'll just use my improv skills to tell jokes.
Right.
And then I hate myself because I stand up there and I don't have a team of, my team members on my improv troupe helping me, and then I'm like, oh shit, stand up is different than improv, you know? So let me just calculate and write everything down. And then I started, as I got better, I would have all my jokes laid out, but then I would also leave, you know, 10 or 15% of my set to chance, to improv, And I would like add things to jokes, or I would like talk to audience members, or I would like just add some improv elements. But I would always have like a base structure of what I was going to do.
Right.
And when I see people like taking the excuse not to write and with no improv training, and, you know, it's just like, bro, can you get off the fucking stage?
Right.
You've been saying what else and slapping your knee for fucking 2.5
right.
minutes, you asshole. So when I am nice to, am nice to new comics. But when they abuse their stage time, it's like, okay, dude, you know, can you get off now? Because you
right.
haven't entertained anybody. Like, at least have standards for yourself.
Right.
You know, and sometimes, you know, in mentoring comics, you know, that are coming up, they need a little kick in the ass of like, do you know that that was just laziness?
Right.
Do you know that that was just lazy? So don't do that anymore.
Right. I love that you have, like, such a... like wealth of knowledge over the years, and you would because you had done it so long. So I just want to have you, you can plug like everything, because I plugged some of your stuff in the intro, but I just want to give you time to, you know, get your stuff out more.
Thank you, Richard Dweck. You're a very sweet boy. People can go to erichollerbach.com and click through the website. That is the best place to go, because it's just, if you click on stand-up specials, erichollerbach.com, that's erichollerbach.com. Click on stand-up specials. You can see conspiracies and dick jokes, fart porn and beer halls. It's a medical device. And I also have a secret album on there that's downloadable for $5 called Lost Bits and Crowd Work.
Right, I saw that.
So check that out. That's great. And, you know, there's, I got a bunch of sketches. I did web series. So there's a lot of free content on erichollerbach.com. So check that out. That's it.
And, I wanted to ask you, just cause I was curious who you have next on your podcast. Cause I know you had Mike, I always say his name wrong.
Melkiewicz.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mike Melkiewicz. Yes. He was just on. So Tuesday night, I'm going to the Reserve Bar in Elmwood, New Jersey, and I have a guest called Luke Rothschild. He is a...
Oh, I know that dude.
He's an heir to the Rothschild banking dynasty, and he's also a, you know, New Jersey open micer. So speaking of my two loves of conspiracies and dick jokes, I did have a conversation with him, and he's very open. That is... his evil family runs the world behind the shadows. So I'm going to ask him all about that.
Yeah, I met him in what was it? Like the Jersey City scene. Like they were.
Yeah.
And that was really cool. Like Bayonne and stuff. I was like, oh, that's like a whole different sect of New Jersey comedians. So I actually have him on my
you
list
have him?
To ask to do my podcast. I have like 80 people that ask. But that's so cool.
So after him, I'm talking to Parker Barnes. Parker Barnes is a friend of mine that I met in New Orleans back in 2016 or so. So he's after Luke Rothschild. But I'm actually, after I get off the podcast with you, I'm going to talk to him and figure out what date that's going to be. Probably next Sunday, a week from today, probably.
So
in New York City, somewhere. Yes.
So you have that, and thank you so much for doing this. I mean, it went way easier than I thought it would. I didn't think it was going to be hard, but I was just like, you know, doing this is new to me. So thank you for being so patient.
Hey, you did a good job. You're improving, and thanks a lot, Richard Dweck. You've been a great friend to me, and you're a sweet boy, and I love you very much.
You too. I love you too. Thank you so much for doing this. All right.
All right. This is...
Hello. This is the intro to Season 3, Episode 4. My interview with Eric Hollerbach. Eric Hollerbach is a veteran comic of, you know, 11 years. He's started in 2009 and
he's done improv with UCB, and he is a screenwriter. He's got a screenwriting degree, and he has a podcast called Highway Diary, and he's fucking great. He's been so great to me and so great to so many other young comics coming up in the New Jersey scene, and he's an absolutely great guy, and he has such a personality, and that sounds like a generic thing to say, but he really does. He's a good dude and a good comic, and we have a lovely conversation, and I'm so happy to share it with you. This is season 3, episode 4, Eric Hollerbach. Enjoy, because I did.